This is the third tape in a series by Thomas V. Taylor, Associate Professor of Church History and Old Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Into that world, John Calvin was born in 1509. Note that Calvin had a relatively short life. None of these guys lived to be octogenarians. Of course, Zwingli was out fighting. Luther was ferociously preaching. Calvin was writing and studying. Calvin, of the three men, had poor health. He had poor health all of his days. Sometimes he couldn't eat well. Sometimes his muscles ached. Sometimes he suffered with arthritis. Sometimes with what's the stuff you can't breathe, asthma. And Calvin went from ailment to ailment most all of his lifetime. He hardly ever missed a day's work because of it and never missed a sermon because of it. He could get out of bed when he could hardly breathe and preach. But he never enjoyed the luxury of good life, of good health. Now, Calvin's work is widespread in that it affects a large segment of the world not touched by the others. Calvin's influence is found in Germany, in some places, southern Germany, found heavily in France, but enormously in England and Scotland, and found in varieties of religious groups. Today, the group is gone, but in Wales, for many years, the group merged with another church, but in Wales, for many years, there was a church known as the Welsh Calvinistic Methodist Church. That body merged with the Presbyterian Church in England, 1929 or sometime about that. But for 250 years, the Welsh Calvinistic Methodist Church, you can see how the influence of Calvin found itself, even circles that grew out of the Methodist revivals, really. But in the Anglican Church, the Church of England, there were great influences of Calvinism in the Presbyterian churches and many Baptist churches, and even in some Lutheran churches that did not sign the Formula of Concord. Even in some of those, there was a strong Calvinistic thrust. The Huguenots are French Calvinists. Yeah, of course, for many years, they're the bulk of the Calvinistic movement, the French Calvinists. But persecutions eliminated them in time. Incidentally, nobody knows why they were called Huguenots. It's an unknown name. There are 20 theories as to why it was chosen, but it's an unknown name, one of those mysteries. So Calvin's sphere of ministry was very worldwide in a practical sense, Now, his background was France, the Renaissance period. His father was what we would call a notary public. That's what he was. He held public office, but a little public office. He was like the guy in town who kept the books. And because he had a public position, he succeeded in getting some tuition money for his son, so his son could go to Paris and study. He wanted him to study law. Because he had an idea that lawyers made money. So he wanted John to study law. And Calvin would switch to studying theology, and he would switch to studying humanities. His father was always unhappy with any switch away from law, because he thought that law was the key to a financially secure future. And then a funny thing happened. His father was keeper of the books in the town of Noyon in France, a religious book. He discovered that the bishop was fudging on his accounts. And because Calvin's father was an honest man, he complained to the authorities. The bishop then accused him of heresy and treason and a whole bunch of stuff. Eventually, he was cleared of charges, but he was a broken man by the time the 6 or 7 years was over, and John Calvin was thoroughly disillusioned with the church by all this. And when his father died, he then went back to Paris to study law. So most of his training was in law, with a few years put into theology on the side. In Paris, he was exposed to evangelical ideas by hanging around with a group of young, kind of like, what youth groups are you familiar with? Like Campus Crusade types today, or Young Life types, or InterVarsity types. Calvin was not healthy, I said that before, but he was intelligent and had a certain amount of wit and had the ability to know what was going to be on the next exam. Plus the fact, he was not a big critic of his colleagues. You've seen some guys that were smart, but all the time they were hassling you on something. He was not that. So he was a popular fellow in his own right as scholar. Scholars are never popular with the prize fighters, but in his own right, he was a popular fellow. And part of an evangelical circle while at the University of Paris, and it was there sometime around 1532, in and around that bracket, that his exposures to evangelical ideas led him to a firm grip of the justification by faith doctrine. See, today we would say, when was somebody born again? The term born again was hardly used in the Reformation at all. The idea was, when did you realize that you were justified by faith? That was the idea. If you went back and read some of the testimonies of these guys in the Reformation, you'd wonder what they were talking about. But that's because every age produces its own vocabulary. And the vocabularies are good ones, it's just no one age has them all.
Now, his exact date of conversion is not known to us, but sometime in the 1530s, he came into the reality of justification by faith, much the same way that Zwingli had come into it. I tried to draw a slight distinction for you between Zwingli and Calvin. When a man is saved, he's equally saved, Zwingli and Luther. But I emphasized the searching that Luther went for years, in which with great agony of soul, he beat himself, flogged himself, did all sorts of excessive things in order to find peace with God. Neither Zwingli nor Calvin were that sort of persons. They were much more matter-of-fact. And it came to them in a kind of a matter-of-fact way that peace with God was just a simple matter of basic justification. They simply believed, that's all. And in their simple belief, that was enough to give them the type of conviction and help that they needed in a spiritual sense. Zwingli and Calvin both went along that sort of a way. But he does not tell us a lot about it in detail, except for the reality of the fact. In Paris, he became associated then with a group of individual persons, Reformation humanists, one of whom was Nicholas Kopp. C-O-P is his name, is spelled on page 7 in my syllabus. Nicholas Kopp. Kopp was one of the members of the faculty at the University of Paris. He was quite evangelical himself, although not too outspoken about it. And so because of his abilities at the university, he was appointed to the position of rector, like the preacher for the whole university, rector. And those things always involve a big ceremonial thing where the man in the new position gives a big speech to tell how glad he is to have it, kind of like our inauguration of the president of this country. And so Kopp had an inaugural speech to give at the university, and he delivered that speech in a powerful way. I'm a little ahead of myself. I'll just tell you that the speech was enormously evangelistic. from that point of view, it might not have passed for a Graham crusade today, but for that time, it was enormously evangelistic. He's strongly evangelical. Some think that Calvin helped him write it. There were some other close men in the circle, too. Nobody knows for sure. But Kopp delivered a very evangelical sermon on the celebration of his inauguration to the chair of rector of the University of Paris. It was so evangelical that it immediately offended beyond belief the Romanists in the fellowship, and they rose up with one body and were ready to stone him, kill him, or whatever the case was. Kopp had to flee for his life. You know, he was inaugurated today, gave his talk, and left by the back door. Kopp literally had to flee for his life. And those that were part of his circle likewise found themselves in jeopardy. Now, it's too complicated to track out all the moves of Calvin in the next few months. We don't really need to do it. Let's just say that for the next few months, he was in a period of doubt and in a period of not being sure really where he was, except that he was slowly leaving the Roman Church. There seemed to be no question about that. He moved back and forth between Paris and parts of Switzerland and northern Italy a couple of times, stayed with various friends, studied, but was actually slowly leaving the Roman Church. Maybe it wasn't so slow, but it worked out that way. He eventually came in walking through Switzerland under the aegis, that's A-E-G-I-S, aegis, of Bill Farrell, F-A-R-E-L, William Farrell. Farrell is not mentioned in my notes, but he ought to be mentioned in connection with Calvin and the break from Rome. He came under the influence of Wilhelm Farrell. Now let me just pause for a few moments and talk about Farrell, just off the cuff. Farrell, too, was essentially a Swiss Frenchman, a Frenchman whose life and ministry was in Switzerland. See, Switzerland is part of it is Italian, part German, and part French in language background. They all merge it together for a happy Swiss dialect. Farrell was from the French part of Switzerland. Farrell was a very powerful preacher. He had red hair, that ought to tell you something, was a powerful preacher, and a very strong supporter by this time of the evangelical movement. He was argumentative beyond belief, bold as can be. when he saw the procession going through the city carrying the statue of the Virgin in front of it, Farrell's idea was to run down quickly, grab the statue, run to the bridge, throw it in the river, preach a few gospel sermons, give a couple tracts out quickly, and take off. That was roughly Farrell's idea. He was bold and audacious and absolutely unintimidatable, whatever that means. He was afraid of nothing. He had worked around Basel, among other places, and became familiar with Calvin, in a real sense in Calvin's publishing of his first copy of the Institutes of the Christian Religion in 1536. The Institutes of the Christian Religion, 1536. That will go through lots of editions before Calvin dies, and quite a few afterwards. It's the great systematic theology work of the Reformation in what we would call the Reformed tradition. Farrell felt the need of someone to help him in the ministry in Switzerland, and so he invited Calvin to do that. Again, the details are too complicated. Farrell invited Calvin to go with him and stay in Geneva. Calvin thought he would just pass through Geneva. But Farrell held a kind of a magic over Calvin that you can hardly appreciate. Farrell felt certain that it was God's desire for Calvin to stay in Geneva. Farrell felt it with as much assurance as anything you could imagine that Calvin should stay and work in Geneva. Consequently, the standard method that he used on Calvin was to inform him that if he did not do what God wanted him to do, the curse of God would be on him. And so Calvin stayed to help Farrell in Geneva for about 2 years. Now, at Geneva, in those years, there was a great deal to be done in the Reformation sense. A great deal to be done. The city was not thoroughly converted. Did I say he stayed about 2 years? A little less than that. But the city was not thoroughly converted. There was a lot of sloppiness and a lot of difficulties in Geneva. And consequently, there was a lot of anguish when Calvin and Farrell began promoting strong doctrines on church order and discipline, in particular with regard to communion. Farrell's view and Calvin's, I think, they followed a view of communion. There I said they five times. I hope you've got that. They followed a view of communion. They wanted it celebrated every day, certainly weekly, but they wanted only persons whose lives were right to take part in it. They felt that licentious and wicked people who simply thought they were Christians because they lived in Geneva should not be admitted to the Lord's Supper, And so they were ready, if necessary, to beat them off with a stick, if necessary. The Genevan Council was much broader. And the division that developed between Farrell and Calvin and the Geneva Council was such that in 1538, the Genevan Council said that they ought to leave the city. Get out, they said. Get out. We'll reform ourselves. And so in 1538, Calvin and Farrell left Geneva. They did not walk out peacefully. They fled. They took off. Their lives were not in danger, I don't think. But they were persona non grata, and they took off. Farrell suggested that Calvin go to Strasbourg, the Swiss city on the German border. Calvin was not really inclined to go, but Farrell threatened him again, and Calvin went to Strasbourg, where he joined forces with Martin Luther's old friend, a man named Bucer, B-U-C-E-R, with a check mark over the C to make sure you say T. Sometimes you'll see it spelled B-U-T-C-E-R, Martin Bucer. That's a C with a check over it, or T-Z, whatever you want to say. Martin Bucer. He was a strong and capable worker for the Lord in Strasbourg. And so Calvin found himself in Strasbourg, working in connection with Martin Bucer. And Bucer had Calvin, or persuaded Calvin, to become the pastor of the French refugee congregation in Strasbourg. It was a large bunch of people. And thus it was, for the next almost 3 years, Calvin pastored the French church in Strasbourg, almost 3 years, preaching daily, ministering, and all that sort of thing. Calvin, as I may have mentioned before, was never a man of great physical strength. He had lots of energy, but he suffered with dyspepsia and weakness and various ailments and all sorts of things. But the 3 years at Strasbourg were enormously happy years for Calvin in the work of the Lord. And during that time, he married they were blessed with one son who died in infancy. And one of the touching moments in Calvin's life are those words that he wrote first over the death of his son, and then 8 or 9 years later over the death of his wife. Now, like Luther, Calvin found a very happy marriage. I think that's true of Zwingli, too. They found that marriage was an institution that completed their lives and gave them a greater rapport, ministry, and understanding with the people to whom they wanted to work. So for 3 years, Calvin ministered in Strasbourg, and then, in 41, returned to Geneva. Calvin did really not want to return to Geneva. Strasbourg was a happy place to work, and he was pleased in what he was doing. But a crisis had arisen in Geneva, and back in 1538 and 39, when the former Catholic bishop had written a powerful letter to the city urging them to return to the faith. The city had not known what to say to it, and so Calvin, even though exiled, had written a response to explain what the evangelical doctrines were, why the evangelicals were doing what they were doing, and why they were not going to return to the Catholic faith. It was a powerful letter that very strongly satisfied Geneva and the councils in Geneva. But the circumstance was not ended quite that smoothly. And so by 1541, the city of Geneva knew that it needed some help external to itself. Calvin was the logical man. He did not want to go. He wanted to stay in Strasbourg and pastor his people and be happy in his work and study there. But once again, Farel said to him, in a nice way, if you don't go to Geneva, God is going to curse you. And so Calvin returned to Geneva in 1541, and he would spend the rest of his life there, dying in Geneva in 1560-something or other. 64, wasn't it? It's funny how you can't remember when they die, in dying in Geneva in 1564. Life was not terribly easy in Geneva. I can merely tell you that there were two or three major events that occurred there that are fairly important to us. But in a nutshell, from 1541 to 1555, Calvin had constant conflicts. That's maybe an exaggeration. But the problem was, I'm looking at figure G on the Reformation ideals, the problem was that Calvin looked for a, he wanted Geneva to be the spiritual Jerusalem. He had no legal office in Geneva at any time. He was not even really a citizen. So he wasn't like the mayor or the sheriff or the chief polyfrog. He was the preacher of the Genevan church. Of course he had enormous influence. But the town council in Geneva would do things that he disapproved of, and he would argue with them, and he would do things they disapproved of, and they would argue with him. But he wanted Geneva to be a pure city, and he was particularly hard on anything that smacked of being different from his ideas of purity. Consequently, at his suggestion and help, the Genevan Town Council enacted laws eventually that forbade the singing in bar rooms or taverns of anything but psalms. You know, if you want to go in and have a schnapps, you should be ready to sing a psalm if you want to sing at all. In addition to that, in the taverns, there could be no loud talking, boasting, or jesting. They made things like prostitution, which were enormously common in the ancient world, they made it an offense that in Geneva few people were willing to run the risk of. Now, we know that you can't legislate people into being good. Calvin knew that too. But he wanted to put away all of the possible offense and worldly trappings that easily lead people to sin. The idea being, if you put enough of them away, at least the sinners will have to go over to Basel or Zurich to find what they want. So Geneva was a very tight city under Calvin. When I say under him, see, he held no administrative position, but under his spiritual advice, it was a very tight city. And that naturally produces a lot of frictions. And so up till 1555, the frictions were there as Calvin constantly feuded with a group that are known in church history as libertines. L-I-B-E-R-T-I-N-E-S, libertines. But in 1555, a victory was won over the libertines, and the last 9 years of his life, Calvin could almost sneeze, and the people of Geneva would sneeze too. Slight exaggeration, but not very much. He would develop in those last few years periods of public instruction. He would start a large school in Geneva. He would insist on standards of righteousness in every aspect of public life. What happened in 1555 to produce that, or in the months around that period? Well, I'll just add an excursus here. I'm down at the Reformation ideals. I've been talking about how Calvin wanted Geneva as a model city. I'll add a little excursus here. It came as a result of the difficulties that had been brought to Geneva by a man named Servetus. Servetus is spelled S-E-R-V-E-T-U-S, Servetus. Servetus was a famous French physician. He had known Calvin in Paris in the evangelical circles to which Calvin had belonged years before. But Servetus had taken a view that denied the deity of Christ and denied the reality of the Trinity. Servetus had taken an heretical view. In 1542, he'd wanted to debate those things with Calvin at Geneva, but Calvin had simply said no purpose could be served and urged him not to come to Geneva. And in a long, complicated event, in the next few years, Servetus was arrested by the Bishop of Lyon in France and put in a dungeon or in a prison. And when his heretical views were studied, he was condemned to death by the Roman Catholic authorities in Lyon. However, he escaped. He was clever, he escaped. Servetus was quite a good physician. He apparently understood the circulation of the blood a century before William Harvey would demonstrate it in England. He escaped from prison and darted around Europe incognito. Hard to hide those things, but he darted around Europe incognito. And then, for some reason, went to Geneva. Why he went to Geneva, not sure. Whether he thought he could just go and live in obscurity, and maybe so. It's hard to know, but he went to Geneva. He was disguised and had changed his name. But he did not reckon with the memory of Calvin. Calvin saw him in Geneva, recognized him, although he hadn't seen him for, I can't give you an exact figure, say 15 years, 15 or 18 years. He hadn't seen him in that long. Calvin saw him, recognized him, disguised or not, reported him to the authorities, and the authorities arrested him. He was a wanted heretic. The authorities arrested him. To make a long story short, he was tried as a heretic in Geneva and burned at the stake. Calvin did not think he should be burned at the stake. Calvin thought maybe he should be hung, a death, but Calvin didn't think he should be let go. A man, Calvin said, who destroys souls is much more of a murderer than a man who simply destroys bodies. And so Calvin did not think he should be let go. But Calvin was not in favor of burning. That he thought was a cruel and wicked death, and that was not his idea of how you dealt with things like that. But he didn't think he should be let go. We're a little defensive on Calvin for this one incident. We should know that in the Roman countries at that time, thousands of peoples died, and in Geneva there were several other peoples executed for various offenses of a similar sort, or maybe even what might seem to us to be a lesser sort. But because Servetus was a famous person and a competent person in his own field, it made life hectic for us yet today talking about it. However, it did a lot to enhance Geneva's reputation for orthodoxy. Even the Catholics were pleased. Because, after all, Servetus had been under a death sentence to the Roman Church already. So all Calvin was doing was really carrying out what certain bishops had already decreed. And while that doesn't make him right, etc., etc., when I say Calvin, I mean the Geneva Council, but he certainly agreed with the death sentence. There are various depictions given of it, but it made him popular, and it showed the other forces in Geneva that they could not brook him. And things began to turn in his favor, and by 1555, Calvin had his own way in Geneva and just about anything he wanted. Just a note on his personal life. Now, Calvin was one of those dedicated hard workers. He never really enjoyed rugged good health, but he was a dedicated hard worker. Up early in the morning, writing, he often would wear out two secretaries before lunch. I used to think that all these guys wrote their books themselves. Well, they were really the authorities of them, but actually they talked them out and other people sat and wrote them, secretaries. Calvin could wear out two of them before lunch on any day of his life. He was very frugal in all of his customs. He accepted a salary at Geneva and accepted a couple of jugs of a couple of barrels of wine that they gave him every year, but he was very frugal in all of his customs. And it's often been said that Calvin's view was that what the Scripture does not specifically allow, we ought to forbid. Calvin and Luther have been contrasted in that point, perhaps a little unfairly. The contrast has been that Luther said, what the Scripture forbids, we may not allow. And Calvin said, what the Scripture does not allow, we must forbid. So their viewpoints on aspects like that were a little different in reality, although that may be a rather extreme way to put them. But his personal life, matters of money and morals and that, was above reproach. His strongest critics could find no fault with it. Like Luther and Zwingli, he loved music, although he was not the accomplished musician that Luther and Zwingli both were. But he loved music. He was responsible for bringing the Psalms into the active role in the church. He harmonized and arranged many of them for the church services. And, of course, was enormously interested in cultivating a deep spiritual life. He is an interesting man. And it's just a sad commentary on the evangelicalism of our day that about half the Christians, when they mention his name, think ill of him. Poor Calvin. Let me mention just a few things with regard to developed concepts. The Institutes were his great theological work. They would go through several editions, the Institutes of the Christian Religion. They are excellent doctrinal reading, and they are still prominent today. The Genevan School, on page 8, started by Calvin after 1555, would have more than 3,000 graduates in the next 30 or 40 years. It would be headed up after his death by Theodore Beza, spelled B-E-Z-A, who would head it up almost till the end of the century. But Calvin believed, as did Luther, in public education. And so a Genevan school system was instituted for everybody, but the Geneva School was Calvin's attempt at starting an institution which would draw people from all over the world to study Scripture. And it did. John Knox studied there. Men of every background came and studied in the Genevan School. And that's why, as I mentioned in C on page 8, Calvin was given a strong international influence. His work was not limited to one language or to one culture, but spanned itself over many cultures and over many different language areas. I think I need say nothing more about that, except that part of it, of course, this international influence was the fact that Geneva saw itself as a refugee center for all sorts of people fleeing the Roman Church, and even a few fleeing Luther. However, it was not a refugee center to the Anabaptists. Calvin was violently opposed to the Anabaptists, strongly opposed to the Anabaptists, as had Luther. However, Calvin was more willing to debate and argue and try to solve the matter by those means. Calvinism after Calvin went through a lot of struggles. I only tell you that the churches that followed Calvin are generally called Reformed churches. They're called Reformed because he emphasized the reform of doctrine. And whereas the Lutheran churches, Luther liked the concept of evangelicals, those with the good news, Calvin liked the concept of a church that re-proclaimed justification by faith. Calvin said in his tracts and treatises, that if a church no longer preached the gospel or conducted the ordinances as Christ gave them, the sacraments, then it was no true church. And the church must be reformed to the point where it preaches the gospel and honors the sacraments. That was a strong, emphatic teaching with Calvin. Consequently, he thought of his work as being the reformed work, the reforming work. Strong concept with Calvin. The reformed work. Hence, the churches that follow him are popularly called Reformed churches. They would include churches like the Dutch Reformed, the old German Evangelical and Reformed, a number of churches like that. And, of course, in the English-speaking world, most of the Presbyterian churches. There are a couple of hombres in that number, too. But most of the Presbyterian churches and the Reformed churches. There was quite a large body scattered throughout the world. You found groups in Hungary like the Hungarian, the Magyar Reformed Church, and things of that sort. So that Calvinism found itself expressed in many churches in the next few centuries. Around 1600, 50 years after Calvin's death, it would go through big arguments over what true Calvinism was, and that argument has not been settled yet to this day. In connection with our country, both the Pilgrims and the Puritans were highly Calvinistic. Many of the Anglican churches are Calvinistic, but the Pilgrims and Puritans were strongly Calvinistic bodies. The Pilgrims, of course, were separatists. They were really a type of English, well, they were separatists. They denounced the existing church and wanted a church of their own. But they were highly separatist, but they were quite Calvinistic. And the Puritans, wanting to stay and reform the Church of England within it, were likewise strongly Calvinistic. Calvinism was at the very base of American society and civilization in the colonial period. And eventually many creeds would be produced out of Calvinism. Now, those of you who may have one time or another belonged to the Evangelical Reformed Church or the Reformed German Church, later the United Church of Christ, will remember the Heidelberg Catechisms and Confessions. Those are Calvinistic creeds. And those of a Presbyterian background will remember the Westminster Confession. Those who may be of a Baptist background will remember the Philadelphia Confession. All of those are essentially Calvinistic creeds. And it's quite a tribute to Calvin's scholarly ability diverse persons could find themselves at home with his theology. We continue in this course into Roman numeral 6, the Reformation Anabaptists. My notes are on page 8. Anabaptists form an important part within the framework of the Reformation and church history since. And it's interesting the way history swings these things around, and one group moves to prominence and another group passes out in time. I mentioned, first of all, capital A, the historical background. The term Anabaptist means to baptize again, to baptize above. The concept was one that is not new in the days of the Reformation, probably is as old as the Christian bodies. The concept is with regard to what would be commonly called today believer's baptism. The idea being that one could not be baptized as an infant and have that be totally satisfactory for his life's baptism. Ironically, some Anabaptists will actually do that in time, but the basic thrust was that one should be baptized again upon profession of faith. This baptism again was looked at by reformers and others in particular in two ways. First of all, they looked at it as defiance of the practices the church had established for the communication of its truth. And secondly, they looked at it as defiance of the state, because they saw the state as already having agreed that the individuals were members of the church state by birth and baptism, and this new baptism tended to deny the validity of what had been done before. So to many of the reformers and thinkers in the 17th, 16th century, Anabaptists were traitors to the state and to the church. I will tell you several times in class that there's no defense to that type of thinking, no proper defense, but that was the sort of thinking that involved itself. It seems that the concept of infant baptism had become so thoroughly identified in the Roman system with the nature of salvation that to deny the validity of baptism to infants was to deny them salvation. And consequently, Anabaptists were looked at as traitors in the framework of the church. And then to deny them the validity of that salvation was to deny them membership in the state. Now, you had a general sense in which the church was united in the baptism of children, with the exception of a few dissenters. And they did not generally look kindly towards the dissenters, because the dissenters were thought as traitors and rebels. We do not know where the first Anabaptists emerged. We know that there were arguments over the validity of Anabaptism. There are arguments over the validity of baptism in the days of Tertullian. Tertullian is the first father that we have provable knowledge of who objected or questioned the rites of infant baptism. The fact that Tertullian could question them about 210 AD, 220, indicates at least that some people were doing it about that time. We do not know exactly when it began. We can make all sorts of assertions, and we don't know what all the objections were. But I think it'd be safe to say that throughout the long history of the church, there are always some people who are on the opposite side of almost every issue, baptism and everything else. So there were probably always a sprinkling of those who wanted to baptize in some other way than in the church-accepted policy. No doubt there were always a sprinkling. I can't tell you who they were in all ages. We can come up with a few names, but they are not always good names. If you read books in the history of these things, a lot of people like to pick up groups, the Cathari, groups like that. But on the whole, their doctrines are so heterodox but they are no credit to any Christian company. So we can't always tell you all their names, but we can pretty safely assert that there always were some, because that's the way people are made. That's kind of the way life goes. But with the coming of the Reformation, Anabaptism can break into the open because of the dissolution of the tight church and state relationships that existed under the Roman countries. Now, the Protestants are not going to give that up, as I've mentioned this class already. Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, they all are state church types. But now, see, instead of there being one state, one church, there are several churches in several states. It's going to make it much easier for divergence to develop. The first big divergence develops in Switzerland, capital B, the Anabaptists in Switzerland. Switzerland was that small, peaceful place that I described to you when we were talking about Zwingli and the particular effect of Zwingli's rule there. Switzerland had always had greater expression of speech than most of the other countries in Central Europe, probably because it was little and nobody worried very much about it. So you had all sorts of varieties in Switzerland, which in Rome would have been punishable by death a long time ago. Zwingli is the prime Swiss reformer. Early in Zurich, he is joined by Conrad Grebel. Conrad Grebel and Hubmaier are the primary Anabaptists in Switzerland, and they are men of great character. Grebel is about Zwingli's own age. Hubmaier is maybe a few months older, but they're all in the same bracket. Grebel will die of the plague, but Hubmaier will be martyred. It is one of those interesting situations in which the reformers, who needed a great deal of freedom for themselves, to a large extent did not want to court it to others. They couldn't see it that way, of course. Everybody is a product of his times, but that's what it boiled down to. So Grebel and Hubmaier in Switzerland worked closely with Zwingli until they discovered that Zwingli was not going with them on the baptismal issues. And at that point, they backed off, and there was a division between them. Zwingli would eventually dislike them very much. They, along with others, were responsible for producing what we would call an Anabaptist confession of faith. Anabaptists have a tendency not to want to be thought of as being confessional. You'll discover that pretty quickly if you have some Anabaptist friends and you talk about these things with them. You'll discover that they don't want to be called confessional. They don't like to think of themselves in that way. And since I'm a non-argumentative type of fellow, I don't like to argue over it either. There is a sense in which they are not confessional, but there's another sense in which everybody produces confessions. So in my bookshelves, I have a book of Mennonite confessions and a book of Baptist confessions. They sound a little different than the Presbyterian confessions, but not a whole lot different, and the general character of them is pretty much the same. The reason that they don't want to be confessional or thought of as being confessional is that they want to think of their systems as being more essentially biblical and more compatible in the long run with the biblical picture. Now, that may or may not be the case. And the emphasis that I would draw is that whatever the case might be, they are still confessional to some degree. But if you have Anabaptist friends and you speak in an Anabaptist convention, they may shoot you. If they are not totally passive, they may just shoot you. But Grebel and Hubmaier and others are instrumental in producing the Schlatheim Confession, S-C-H-L-E-I-S, let's go slowly, Thomas, S-C-H-L-E-I-T-T-E-I-M, sometimes shortened to Schlatt, the Schlatheim Confession, 7 articles, produced about 1527. And while they certainly were not binding, they were nevertheless expressive on the views of the group. And since statements are one of the chief ways of defending yourself against the accusations of error, a number of other Baptist and Anabaptist statements will come over the years. None of them will be authoritative in the sense that all of them get together and say, this is what we want to do. There are too many varieties in that line. But the Anabaptist movement in Switzerland was generally a healthy movement. It was maintained by godly men who promoted biblical truth to a very large extent. When you come to Germany, you can't stay in the same country forever in this course. When you come to Germany, you become more aware of the diversity within the Anabaptist group. So we'll just take a few moments and chat about capital C, Anabaptists in Germany. There are as many different types of Anabaptists, probably, as there are any group that you can think of. The ones in Switzerland were prone to be peaceful fellows, preachers, evangelists, Bible teachers. There are some of those in Germany, too. But Germany also got a big number of radical Anabaptists. You remember what I said earlier in this course about the constitution of Germany, the many different territories and many different countries making it a Teutonic body, but not a welded union after the pattern that we know it today or have known it in our lifetimes. Consequently, a certain amount of diversity was possible in Germany just because you could go easily from one territory to another. You just slip along. So in Germany, the Anabaptists developed along two definitive lines. One of them we may call the anarchists. The anarchists. And the other we might call the theocrats. The anarchists and the theocrats. The anarchists would be typified, as far as I can tell you, by men like Thomas Storch, the Storch brothers, eventually Andrew Karlstadt, and Boden. He is sometimes called Andreas Bodenstein and Karlstadt, Luther's one-time friend. He is from Bodenstein. Consequently, he is named by the name of the town. But Karlstadt is the name of the town. Bodenstein is the name. Andrew of Karlstadt. Have we got that? Everybody write it down together? Yeah. Well, whatever the case is, they represented a radical faction, anarchists. Of course, things were terrible in Germany, so they took the side of the peasants and the peasants' war and felt keenly that revolution was all you could do. Pull down the cathedrals, shoot the priests. After all, priests have been shooting us for years and that sort of thing. It's hard to know if we're really representing them fairly. You know, if you pick up Martyr's Mirror and some of those things, you'll discover that they have a slightly different view of some of these things. But it seems safe to say that the Storch brothers and Thomas Münzer and Nicholas von Ohrmsdorf and those men were, to a large extent, anarchists. Do away with the government and kind of let the people run their own. But in Germany, along with those, there were the men who argued for a kingdom state on the earth. Just for a kingdom state right here and right now, we might call them theocrats. Among those would be found a man like Melchior Hoffman. Hoffman was a fellow who argued quickly for the kingdom of God's coming soon. He thought it would come at Strasbourg. He thought it would come with him. They put him in prison in Strasbourg. He predicted he would die there, and that prediction proved to be correct. But the theocrats really got a jump at Münster, and working with the help of John of Leiden, Leiden is spelled L-E-Y-D-E-N or L-E-I-D-E-N, and Jan Matthys. Matthys is M-A-T-T-H-Y-S. Working with John of Leiden and Jan Matthys, the Anabaptists actually took over the city of Münster, drove out the bishop, and for about 2 years instituted a theocracy there. They restored polygamy and various other practices and demonstrated that they too could torture those that stood against them. You will discover that in modern terms, many Anabaptists today don't want to admit any relationship with Thomas Münzer, and a good many don't want to even admit that that the town of Münster exists and that the Münster theocracy ever exists. They are sore spots, but they do demonstrate how every movement has a radical fringe. And so whereas normally we think of Anabaptists as being rather passive and peaceful, if you had lived at Münster in the period of time around 1533, 1534, that's the height of the Münster theocracy, if you'd lived there, you would have found that they were not all passive. Some of them were downright nasty, and some of them were militant. So in Switzerland, you had on the whole, a pacifistic, evangelistic type of movement. In Germany, you tended towards radicalism. Luther hated the Anabaptists. As I said earlier, there's no justification for his attitude, but he hated them. He saw them as traitors and rebels. He saw them as the promoters of dissent. He saw them as threatening the fiber of his own reformation by bringing in the imperial forces to bring law and order back to the country. Now, Luther was not beyond persecuting Anabaptists. And I suppose if he'd gone to Münster, they might have persecuted him, but he was not opposed to that at all. So you discover very quickly that the Anabaptist leaders, both in Switzerland and in Germany, fell out of harmony with the chief Reformation leaders in those countries, but for rather different reasons. The salvation, so to speak, of the Anabaptists developed in the Low Country under the teaching of Menno Simon. Menno Simon died in 1559, was born in 1492. Now, Simons had been a Catholic priest, and he witnessed a number of Anabaptists being martyred when the building in which they were living was surrounded by soldiers and burned to the ground. The tradition tells us that he was so struck with their testimony and faith that he converted and became an Anabaptist himself. He certainly left the Roman Church, gave up his priesthood, and by 1536, or about 1536, had identified himself with the Anabaptist bodies. Now, Simons has a few theological problems that bother us. They are major in some ways and not so major in other ways, but a few theological problems that bother us with regard to his understanding of Christ's person. But essentially, Simons is a loyal Christian, a passive person, and an individual who thinks that the believer's chief life ought to be occupied with enjoying God and doing God's will. Simons is a breath of fresh air as compared to the German Anabaptists, and much closer to the Swiss Anabaptists in ideal. He becomes the prime preacher of them. The Mennonites today, of course, are named from him, from Menno Simons. He becomes the prime preacher of them. He has an uncanny ability to be one step ahead of the armies of the emperor, whoever's after him. He leaves just before they get there. I don't think it could ever be said he ran. He just moved, and it's hard to pick up a fellow that just moves. It's just the way it goes. But in the Low Countries, he was enormously influential. And, of course, that influence soon spread into Germany and into France. And so you get a third strain of the Anabaptist movement through Simons. Now, in time, the Anabaptist movement of Simons will more or less, when we say movement, you can't think of an organized group. You've got to think of an influence spread. The influence of Simons in time will link itself very tightly with the influence in Switzerland. Eventually, the very radical movements in Germany will all be killed or driven out of the country. And the Anabaptists will move in Europe. As they are persecuted, they'll move to a place where they're not persecuted. That was part of Simon's idea. His concept was you don't need to resist, you just move. And, of course, in his day, you could keep moving. Eventually, a lot of them moved to Russia. But generally speaking, it's only a matter of time till the body will be persecuted in its new home because of the centrality of their own ideals displacing the ideals of wherever they go. Under capital E, I mention again the radical Anabaptist groups, the millennialists. They would be headed up by men like Hoffman, and the theocrats with John Mathis. And many of the Anabaptists were millennialists, that is, they thought the millennium was coming soon. Thought it was practically here. Oh, boy. It was not the millennium they hoped for, because many of them were martyred and suffered cruelly. So I'll just take a note here and say that when persecutors get to working on you, they don't stop and say, well, are you one of the good Anabaptists or not? To be an Anabaptist in 1540 was to invite a lot of trouble for yourself. The Martyr's Mirror is that publication out of Herald Press and out of Scottsdale, in which the martyrs of the Anabaptist group in before and after the Reformation are sketched, and every Protestant ought to read it. Every evangelical ought to read it. And particularly those in Reformed and Lutheran circles ought to read it to understand that persecution is a tool which men use against each other without great intelligence. Of course, I think Fox's Book of Martyrs ought to be read, too, and you'll discover in some places that the Anabaptists have likewise have been persecutors. To persecute, to establish ourselves, is very much in the heart of most of us. But I've always kind of admired the movement, you see, and most of us in this present day and age owe it a great deal in terms of background. The whole concept of we work with regard to freedom of a church within a state is a concept to which we are very indebted to the Anabaptist thinkers and to their workers. We've long discovered that pacifism is really not a strong force as the movements develop. That isn't exactly fair. It both is and isn't. They have a tendency to be pacifistic in circumstances where they have no choice, but kind of militant, where there are enough of them to do something. That is not Simon's idea. And I don't want to elaborate on it too much. It's hard to explain in detail. But the persecution is locked in the heart of most of us, and we have to be very careful that it doesn't come out at a very difficult time. I wanted to say a few words about the Anabaptist ideals, of which I mentioned four. One is freedom of conscience. Freedom of conscience in religious matters. That is an Anabaptist ideal. It was almost unknown in the age of the Reformation. Almost everybody, from the Pope down to Luther, could tell you what you ought to think and could argue with you pretty heatedly if you didn't think it. The Anabaptists argued for freedom of conscience in matters of religion. As I said before, forgive me for being repetitious, as I said before, they argued for it. They were not always willing to give it, but they argued for it. The second ideal was freedom of assembly. The idea being that the local church was autonomous and not part of a big polyglotinous institute with long arms that reached out and controlled everything. Each assembly responsible to God for its own conduct and its own activity. That's the second Anabaptist ideal. The third one is freedom and toleration of ideals in life. Now the Anabaptist group often become a little weak on this. They develop lifestyles for themselves and perpetuate those lifestyles as being a method of identification and purity. There's not so much seen of that today unless you're in the Amish country. If you go in the Amish country, you'll see a lot of it, but 50 years ago, you'd see a lot of it everywhere. They tended to develop a legalism for themselves which defied this ideal. But where they were a minority party under persecution, this ideal was announced very forcefully, toleration in ideals. So that with regard to manner of life and fulfillment of life, self-determination was promoted. You discover when you become a consolidated body, you discover that that is a dangerous ideal. Your son decides that he really wants to watch television. Or raise chickens for chicken fighting, or any number of other things that you couldn't tolerate. Consequently, of all the Anabaptist ideals, freedom and toleration of ideas, that's had the biggest struggle. The fourth ideal was freedom from ecclesiasticalism. Freedom from institutional life, freedom to form, order, and direct the practices of the local company in accord with your wish. I'd like to say, if you'd like to read more on this, there's lots of readings on the Anabaptist history. Up at Providence Bookstore, you can get them by the tons. But Eastep's book on the Anabaptists is really good. Book entitled The Radical Reformation, the story of the Anabaptists, Eastep, is really good. The Reformers and Their Stepchildren, likewise a good book, by Verduin, V-E-R-D-U-I-N. And lots of other interesting literature on it, too. Today, I would say that, although the Baptist brethren today kind of hate to be called Anabaptists, a lot of them like to think that their roots go back to John the Baptist or someplace like that. But today, the Anabaptist ideals dominate in the Western world. And they themselves, in some degree, have become a very, very large portion of evangelical Christianity. If we think narrowly, we're prone to think of just the Mennonites and Amish as being Anabaptist, Church of the Brethren and the Dunkards. But actually, all of those bodies who teach a baptism of believing persons or professedly believing persons with the autonomy of the local church, all of those bodies are Anabaptist in character and in background. Well, you know, it's like everything else in this course. We have to press on. We press on from the Anabaptists on page 9. We press on with them to the Reformation in England. And tonight I'm looking with you at the Reformation in England. It's kind of interesting to us because most of us have an Anglo background of some type. Even if you came from Germany, you become more interested when you get to England than if we went to Greece or the Ukraine. So because of that connection, because of the English language and a certain commonality that exists between English peoples, why we feel a little closer when you start speaking English, or misspeaking, as the case may be. So the Reformation in England never really came like it did in Europe. It's a peculiar thing. Of course, you get prejudicial views from me, and from any teacher you do. But the Reformation in England was about 85% political, about 5% spiritual, and about 10% something else you can't really identify. Now, in time, it came to be spiritual. But see, in Germany, Luther was suddenly gripped by the concepts of justification by faith and began to preach them powerfully. Frederick the Wise supported him, and they soon had a movement going in which the chief factor was the gospel. In Switzerland with Zwingli, you had much the same thing. In France and Geneva with Calvin, you had much the same thing. There were a dozen places of Europe where you had that, where there was a renewal of the interest, the saving message, and suddenly a great proclamation of the gospel. But it was not that way in England. The break in the Reformation in England was largely a matter of the political machinations and movements of Henry VIII.
And the gospel, there were people who believed it and people who preached it, but the gospel does not become the dominating factor in the English Reformation until the Reformation movement is 30 years old. And even then it is kind of colored with politics. So the Reformation in England is quite different than the Reformation on the continent, in that England, it was spurred by political movements. And then it remained for a few very godly men to sell the populace on the gospel and to sell the populace on the importance of the gospel. And it will take in England, you know, don't quote me year for year, but it will take in England a good 75 years to get the Reformation ideals firmly established and bring it to a place where it could be called a Reformation country. Some of the background of Great Britain. So just a few words about the Reformation in England, the background of it. We're not sure when Christianity came to the British Isles, but sometime before 200 AD. Sometime before 200 AD, Christianity came to the British Isles. By the British Isles, we mean general, you know, Great Britain, all those little islands scattered around about it, including Ireland and the Isle of Man and all of those places. That's when it moved into England, sometime before 200 AD. Maybe before 100, but certainly before 200. The church was very well established by 300. Well, of course, that was a big trading center. You know, the ships went from Rome to England to get tin and the various bronze artifacts, so presumably it just went with the trade movements. Presumably. There's no proof. But presumably it went with the trade movements and to some degree with the Roman forces. But by 300, it was strongly entrenched in England. Now, when I say the British Isles, I mean England proper now, and some of the smaller islands, like the Isle of Man and the Isle of Wight, they had churches on them. Ireland did not. Ireland was not evangelized for some time yet. Scotland was still pretty much a wild, barbarous place, and Wales was full of guys that just as soon cut your head off as give you an offering. But in what we would call England itself, the London territories and that section of England, England itself had quite a strong church by 300 AD. The gospel didn't spread too far north. The barbaric nature up there held it back, and it didn't spread too far west. But it was quite strong in 300 AD, and there were representatives of the English churches who came to the first synods, the first big meetings of the church after Christianity became legal, 314, 325 AD. Representatives from England attended those churches. But then a peculiar thing happened. The Roman Empire lost its military might, and the Saxons from the Teutonic territories of Europe invaded Great Britain. And really, Christianity, by 400 AD, Christianity had been almost exterminated in Great Britain. Almost. England, you know, the British Isles. Almost. Only vestiges of it were left. A cross here and there, an altar here and there. But no visible physical church was left. Celtic peoples who followed religious practices of Christianity were either driven to the extreme portions of the island or went back to Europe. Many of them went back to Europe and settled in what is called Brittany, that part of France. Quite a few did that. But by 400 AD, Christianity had been virtually exterminated in Great Britain, and then it began to slowly seep back. There were Irish missionaries working in the northern part of England in 600 AD. Ireland was converted about 490 AD through the work of Patrick and his guys. But by 600 AD, Irish missionaries were working in the northern part of England, and a couple of missionaries sent by some of the churches in Italy were working in southern England by 600. And for all intents and purposes, you can say that England had again become a Christian country. You have to use it with quotes, but it had again become a Christian country by 700. It certainly was thoroughly Christian if you understand the way we use Christian. We're not talking about people we're talking about people who profess the true faith. You'll remember the King Alfred, the great English king, known for his in the 9th and 10th century, known for his building of schools and driving out the Danes and everything, was first of all pronouncedly a Christian. He was very loyal to the Bishop of Rome, because when he was a little boy, he'd been traveling with a British military force, and somebody had introduced him to Leo the Fourth, who was the Bishop of Rome. You know, when I say introduced him, I mean it said, "This little kid is one of the princes in England, Leo." And Leo had looked at him and put his hand on Alfred's head, and he said, "Someday," he said, "you will be the King of England." And he said, "When you are the King of England," he said, "spread the faith." Now, whether he exactly said that, or whether he said, "Get out of my way, kid," or "Keep those sticky hands off my robes," whatever he said, Alfred always remembered that the Bishop of Rome had told him when he was a little boy that someday he would be King of England, and when he was, he should propagate the faith.
And Alfred the Great sought to do that. He beat off the Danes and built churches and monasteries and all that sort of stuff. But England, like most of the other territories, politics and religion merged in a big controversy. They were all religious, but none of them were really what you'd call devout. So by the time you get to 1500 A.D., England certainly had the form of religion. It had some of the best-known universities in Europe. It certainly had some men who were preachers and humanists and scholars. But the desire to promote England as a political territory was stronger than any religious fervor. And the result was that politics tended to dominate the scene, and politicians used religionists whenever they could. I've already made a note or two comparing England with the continental nationalities, but I'll make this further note. England was really a small country. The time of age in which we're talking about, England had a population of about 3 million people. Compared with Spain, it had a population of about 17 million people, and France had a population of nearly 30 million people. Germany with a population, and Germany was, that's a whole bunch of places, but Germany with a total population of well over 30 million and maybe as many as 40 million people. So England was really a small country compared to all of those. England was closer to Denmark, which had between 2 and 3 million people, and somewhat bigger than Norway, which we're not sure, but didn't have a whole lot of people. But England was a rather small country. But England had been an industrial giant. It's hard to know just why those things happened, but they had been that. And from England, the sheep and the wool of sheep all over Europe came to be made into various woolen things in England. English coal mines sold coal everywhere. They were manufacturing iron as early as anybody in the European continent. And so even though it was a rather small place, it exercised an influence far greater than the size of it would have suggested. And being away from Europe, having the channel between it and Europe, it was spared from any wars it did not want to get into. Now, they wanted to get into plenty of wars. It's amazing the ambition of some of the English kings, tried to conquer Spain, tried to conquer France, and one time did control about 3/4 of France. The ambition of the English kings. But none of those wars were fought on British soil. The only one, of course, when William of Normandy conquered them in 1066, but that's another story. He had a right to the throne, technically, anyway. But these wars were fought, you see, on Europe. Europe was constantly fighting wars, and that upset civilization like crazy. But England was not. England was sitting over there in the island, drinking whatever, just being that. Free for enterprise, because they were surrounded by water, they were enormously given to the sea. And the English sailors, like the Portuguese, incidentally, sailed everywhere and getting things honestly and dishonestly, whatever the case might be, whatever worked out the most convenient with the least fuss. They worked along both lines. So in many ways, the English people were far better off than most of the people of Europe. They had a better economic standard, and they had considerably more freedom under the famous Magna Carta and the British Parliament. That brings us to Henry VIII. The problem is I talk too much about these fellows, but that brings us to Henry VIII. A lot of other things could be mentioned. Henry VIII is the hero and the heel in the British Reformation. There's a lot to be said about him that I don't know how to say it exactly, so I will blunder with it. Without him, humanly speaking, without him, there would have been no English Reformation. He was to England what Luther was to Germany, except Luther was a gospel preacher and Henry VIII was a tyrant, who just had to have his own way about everything. The only reason that he left or broke with the Roman Church was because he could not have his own way staying in it. In his heart, he was always a Romanist. And if he had lived another 2 or 3 years, he certainly would have been received back into the Roman Church. If they had had a conciliatory pope, he would have been received in a long time before that. But they got some hard-minded popes in Rome who did not know how to work diplomatically. A clever pope like the present pope, Henry would have never left. This guy would have figured out a way to handle him. But there were 3 or 4 singularly inept popes at this time, and they made things not even Henry could stand it. So he is to England what Luther was to Germany, but not spiritually, just as far as the Reformation force was concerned. And because of his absolute insistence on his own way, he was able not only to break with the church, but to get Parliament to pass all the laws and all the rules and all the things he needed to maintain his independence from the Roman system. And he died, if you'll forgive me, fortunately, at the right time. A couple of years earlier wouldn't have hurt. A couple of years later would have been catastrophic, and as far as men can see. But he is the single most important factor in the English Reformation, bar none. As far as his life was concerned, he was the second son of Henry VII. You can live all your life and not be unhappy about that. But here's why it's important. Now, Henry VII had seen England come successfully to the conclusion of the War of Roses in 1485. The English houses of Lancaster and York had fought a civil war for more than 40 years. It was finally ended in 1485, in which the family to which Henry VIII belongs, the Tudor family, they emerged victorious at last and united the kingdoms of England and the dukes of England in 1485, Henry VII. Henry VII was anxious that they not go through a mess like that again. After all, if you're having a civil war, you can't go over and fight the French. There was nothing he wanted anymore to go over and bash the French. But you can't do that when you have to bash each other. He had two sons. His oldest son was named Arthur. You can be happy and not know that, too. But his name was Arthur. And his second son was Henry. Why he didn't name the first son Henry, we'll never know. If he had, the whole course of history would have been different. We would have been talking about Arthur the First instead of Henry the Eighth. But his first son was named Arthur. Arthur was trained to be the next king. Henry VII thought there had to be a union between king and church, and so Arthur was trained to be the next king, and his son Henry was trained to be the next archbishop. Now, technically speaking, the kings couldn't appoint archbishops, but they had a lot to say about it. So Arthur was trained for military skills and all that kind of stuff, and Henry VIII, as we will later call him, learned Latin and Greek and how to read and write and do a lot of other things, training to serve in the church. His father was anxious that Arthur have a strong throne, and so he arranged a marriage, like the kings do. He arranged a marriage with the king of Spain. Not to marry the king of Spain, but he arranged a marriage for his son Arthur with the daughter of the king of Spain. Her name was Catherine. Spain was the most powerful country in Europe at the time. And Henry VII, as clear as day, said, "We're going to attack the French someday. Ha ha ha, we're going to do it. If the Spanish are our allies, we should be able to do it well." Plain as day. So he successfully married his son Arthur to Catherine of Aragon. The only thing was that Arthur got sick and died. And it left Catherine a widow early in life. And it frustrated the plans of Henry VII. But he still had his son Henry. And so he designated that Henry would be the next king. He's the only male heir left, so that was obvious. And thought that he ought to continue the alliance with the king of Spain no matter what, and so he insisted that Henry marry Catherine, Arthur's widow. Now, because of complications in the family line, they had to get a special permission from the Pope to do it, and Henry VIII was not happy about it. He didn't like the idea of marrying a Spaniard to start with, especially a woman with a long face and black hair, but whatever the case was, he agreed. But as he agreed, he wrote a protest paper, like a diary paper, which in effect said, "I wouldn't do this if they weren't making me." That's what it said in effect. But he and Catherine were married. That's a rather interesting point. You're no doubt aware that he had a bunch of wives in time. Catherine was his first one. In many ways, she was probably his best one. They had several children, most of whom died either at birth or just after birth. And Catherine had a few miscarriages into the bargain, a total of 7 or 8 fruitless childbearing attempts. The only child who lived was a sickly girl named Mary. She wasn't named Mary because she was sickly, but her name was Mary and she was sickly. She was the only child who lived. Catherine had plenty of children in prospect, but they died. And consequently, by the time of 1525, Henry had no heir to the throne, except a spindly girl named Mary. Now, we'll talk about that in a minute. He found himself as King of England, and in some ways responsible for the English church, but with no heir to the throne. And the problem was, what would happen if he died? The problem, if he died. Would England go through another big civil war? Will there be a bloodbath with the House of Lancashire and York? Now, how much he was influenced to think purely about the problem and how much he was just a lustful old man, we will probably not know in this life. But the problem was very real. Having no heir for the throne and no way for the throne to be successfully treated bothered him. And so he was perplexed about that. He received a suggestion from Thomas Wolsey, who served as Archbishop of York and served as, Wolsey was a clergyman but a politician most of his life. He received a suggestion from Wolsey that he have the marriage with Catherine annulled. After all, he hadn't wanted it. It had been kind of forced on him. She was really Arthur's wife, etc., etc. So he suggested that he have the marriage annulled by the only man in the world who could do it successfully. That would be the Bishop of Rome, the Pope. Now there is a little wrinkle here. I may have intimated at it one day. Catherine of Aragon, the Spanish queen. Catherine of Aragon seems to have been a fine woman. It's hard to tell 400 years later, but she seems to have been a fine woman. She was the aunt of the man who is now emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. His name is Charles V. We met him with Luther. He conducted the Diet of Worms and allowed Luther to leave on his safe conduct. Charles V is the grandson of Ferdinand and Isabella. The grandson. Catherine of Aragon in that same family is his aunt. And for reasons that we don't know, he thought of her as being second only to Mary in terms of virtue and holiness. It's hard to say it just right, but Charles V looked at her with reverential awe. There was no better woman in the world than Catherine of Aragon. Just tuck that in your mind somewhere. Now Wolsey suggests to Henry that he get the Pope to annul the marriage, to say that the marriage was never valid, that Henry and Catherine of Aragon had lived in a state of improper wedlock for 22 years. A convenient state, but for 22 years. That was Wolsey's suggestion. The Pope is Clement VII. He's one of the bunglers. He's really one of the heroes of the Protestants, but one of the bunglers in the Roman order of things, Clement VII. Clement VII did not trust the emperor. He was afraid that Charles would get too powerful. So a lot of things happened all at once. In 1528, the Germans had held a diet at Speyer, you'll remember my mentioning it, where the Protestants objected and they went out saying protestare, protestare, and the name Protestant developed there. But in 1528, the emperor practically had the Protestants crushed. But Clement VII was afraid that if the emperor didn't have any opposition, you know, he would run everything and he'd come down and tell him how to run the Vatican. And so at the height of his overcoming the Protestants, Clement persuaded the King of France to attack Charles and to reduce his military power. And in order to help on that, he loaned Charles the papal, loaned Francis of France, he loaned the King of France the papal army too. So just at the time when it looked to Charles like he could crush the Protestants, suddenly the King of France, allied with the papal forces, declared war on him on the pretense of reclaiming some little territories they said he shouldn't have. Can you catch the force of that? He had to stop fighting the Protestants and fight his fellow Catholics, quick-like. I would like to tell you, he was mighty irritated with the Pope. He was irritated with the King of France, too, but he was super irritated with the Pope. And so when he got the King of France beaten off, which he did pretty often, then he sent the army to Rome. And the army camped around Rome. They made a nice circle and camped around Rome. And Charles said they would not sack or burn the city. They actually did after a while, but he said they wouldn't. But he said they were there to make sure the Pope did nothing more to hurt his cause. Now, Charles was still not able to go back and attack the Protestants because the Turks attacked the next year. And he had to help them get the Protestants help to fight the Turks. But just at this point of history, when Clement has made Charles unbelievably mad. And when Charles has an army all around Rome, just at this moment of history, the men come from England and ask Clement to say
that Charles's sainted aunt has lived in adultery for 22 years. Can you catch the force of that? Can you catch the force of it?
If they had come 3 years earlier, Clement would have done anything Henry wanted. England paid more money to the papacy than any country in Europe. It was one of the smaller countries, but it was the biggest single source of revenue the papacy had. If Henry's men had come in 1525, the Pope would have said, well, better make it 26. The Pope would have said, go, sure, Henry, anything you want. Just throw her in a dungeon or something. But here with Pope and Rome and the armies of the enemy all around, the armies of the emperor, the men of Henry say, call the emperor's aunt a wicked woman. Say that she's lived in adultery for 22 years and the marriage can be annulled. If Clement had said it, he would have been hanging upside down by the heels from St. Peter's or some other lofty spot in about 2 weeks, and he knew it. You can follow that, can you? So he hemmed and hawed. He begged for time. He got about 8 months to work on the project. But he just could not come up with anything. He got about 8 months to work on it. But he couldn't, the emperor wasn't going to leave, and there was nothing he could do. Henry got tired. Henry got boiling mad. He got super mad. He got mad enough at Wolsey to have Wolsey thrown in prison and tried for treason. Wolsey was good enough to die before they could execute him, but that isn't quite right. That's roughly what it boiled down to. But Henry was super mad, didn't know what to do. He couldn't get the annulment. He was stuck with no heir. He probably already had 14 concubines scattered around the castle, if we knew it, but he had no legal heir, and the British people, whatever else they were loyal to the church. And so Henry's hands were shackled. And somewhere at that point, either Thomas Cranmer or Thomas Cromwell. Thomas Cromwell is not to be confused with Oliver Cromwell. But either Thomas Cranmer or Thomas Cromwell, or maybe one or both of them, offered Henry a big suggestion. They said, who is the head of the Church of England? Who is it? And Henry looked at him and he said, well, I suppose it's the Pope. He's the head of everything else. Henry had been a loyal and devoted Roman, whatever you want to call him, all these years, and they said, who is the head of the Church of England? He said, well, I suppose it's the Bishop of Rome. And then they smiled at him and they said, well, do you really think it's that? Or do you think it's the king of the land where the church is? And a little light dawned in the back of his mind. And at their suggestion, was, the head of the church can annul the marriages. Announce yourself head of the church and then announce that the marriage with Catherine was illegal and it's annulled. You can see how simple that was, can't you? Say there are a lot of things that happen here in the next few years in which I don't profess to have all the dates exactly right. All the dates would not help you terribly. But this is about 1530. About 1530. It took a little while to sell it. But by 1533, it had been pretty well sold. And Henry would declare himself head of the English church. He would announce that Catherine was being set aside. She was given a nice castle and an armed guard and a big budget, but she was pretty irritated about it. Catherine was set aside. Mary was put in a private under house arrest too, just to keep her off the scene. And Henry then in 1533 was free to marry Anne Boleyn. Did any of you see the television program Anne of the Thousand Days? Anybody see that? I don't know who gets the time to watch all these things anyway. I just happen to know they're on. I don't watch them. Not that I wouldn't if I could. If they're historical, I would kind of enjoy them. But but that was a program sometime in the last 2 years on the life of Anne Boleyn. Anne of the Thousand Days, because that's about how long she lasted as queen. But Henry in 1533 married her. Now there was tremendous resentment of what he did in England. But there were two things that helped him enormously. I'll just tuck them in here under this heading of the break with Rome. There were two things that helped him enormously. One was that Henry discovered that all of the English clergy were guilty of violating a law which had been passed in 1373, or thereabouts. It was a law that forbade any clergyman to appeal to a foreign power outside of England without the consent of the English king. It was a political enactment in the 14th century designed to make the king more powerful than the bishops.
Well, it was one of those laws that everybody had forgotten. It's like when I had my automobile accident a long time ago, probably 20 years ago. I met a fellow at an intersection up here on 611. Who hit whom, I suppose, could be argued over. I thought he hit me. The fact that I had to, he was driving a farm tractor, the fact that I had to pull his wheel weights out of the door and side of my car made me think he hit me. He claimed that I sideswiped him. Anyhow, I'm not fond of those things. But here we are in court, the big trial. My insurance company won the case and gained back all their money and mine too and all that kind of stuff. But quite apart from that, here's the day of the big trial for this pumpkin seed jury up in Doylestown. The day of the big trial. The attorney looks at me and he says, Mr. Taylor, he said, when entering the intersection, he said, approximately what speed do you think your car was maintaining? You know it's hard. It's 8 minutes later. Who remembers what speed your car is maintaining? I said, well, I said, I don't know. But I said, I'm sure that it was not more than 50 and not less than 40. So the intersection of Warrington on 611. I said, I'm sure it wasn't more than 50 and not less than 40. But I said, you can't watch the speed, et cetera. He said, yeah. Oh, good, good, he said. But you're sure it's more than 40? I said, sure. It's a 50 mile. And then he pulled out a book on Pennsylvania law, and he said, how do you understand this law enacted by the legislature in 1911 requiring all automobiles approaching an intersection governed by a traffic signal to slow to less than 15 miles per hour? And the attorney representing the insurance company said, what? And the judge leaned over and said, what? The jury woke up and said, you know. So he read us the statute. That statute had been in the books for all those years. The judge was unaware of it. My attorney was not. I had a dud for an attorney, but the insurance company did. Yeah. Well, you see, that's a dumb law. It's a dumb law. But it just, they've been ignored. Everybody neglected it. And that's kind of the way it was. Well, Henry found that all these clergymen were violating that law. He had them all charged with treason. You know what the penalty is for treason? It's being hung. He had them all charged with treason and had them all convicted. It was easy. There was no question about it. They were as guilty as sin. But he wasn't going to execute them all. He gave them the opportunity to repent by admitting that he was head of the church. There were several who wouldn't do it. Some were exiled, some were martyred. But the vast majority of them said, oh boy, Henry, you really look like the Pope after all. You look pretty good to us. So in that way, he manipulated the clergy to accept him as supreme head, and then he did a striking thing just about 1536. He confiscated the monasteries, all the monasteries, and divided their property and their goods up among the common people and the lords and the nobilities. And having already persuaded the government the church to accept him, he now won the support of the common people by oppressing the parts of the Roman church that they distrusted the most, the monastic orders. And because Henry was it's hard to describe him exactly. He hardly had any redeeming moral characteristics, but he was a big gung-ho type who liked to wrestle and drink and joust with the boys. He had a huge popular image, and so he was able to carry it off. Now, at this time, there was still no common Bible translated into English. Tyndale had been trying. Henry hated Tyndale somewhat more than he hated Luther. He regarded Tyndale as a traitor. And you know, they had this fabulous burning of Tyndale's New Testament in London several times. But Tyndale had thousands of New Testaments that were being shipped into London, and one of Tyndale's commissioners came back and said he shouldn't ship any more because he said the English police were buying them up and destroying them as fast as they got in, to which Tyndale replied that that was good. And when the commissioner was surprised that Tyndale would think that was good, Tyndale noticed the money they were paying to buy them up, he could print twice as many as they were burning. You know, let them burn. As long as we're making a profit out of them, let them burn. We'll keep producing them on and on. Kind of a clever thing in the English Reformation. But Henry hated Tyndale. Tyndale stayed out of England, but eventually in 1535, Tyndale was caught and arrested in Belgium and burned at the stake. Henry could have saved him by wiggling his finger, but he would not do it. He hated Tyndale and was very quick to consent to Tyndale's death. But now, with the break from Rome, it seemed that the logical thing to do would be, he had won the priesthood by having them accused as traitors, he'd won the people by giving them the lands, and now he needed something to consolidate himself, so he
decided to allow them to have the Bible in English. Then, among other men, Miles Coverdale prepared an English translation. It was very popular.
This series is continued on the next cassette. Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For more information about the seminary or a free cassette catalog, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.